Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA. History is often described as the collective experience of mankind. But that collective experience is really the blending of millions of individual stories. And each of our lives is indelibly affected by the larger currents of reality that surround us. That fact dramatically underlies a new novel, Shanghai Legacy, that is based upon the historical fact of the plight of those Jews who fled the approaching Holocaust for the squalor of Shanghai, the only place on earth that would admit them without a visa. Once again, the power of creative fiction is used to reveal the greater truths of history's power to affect lives and relationships across time and generations. And my guest is Marion Cuba, author of Shanghai Legacy.
Hello.
Marion, welcome to Dialogue.
Happy to be here.
And let me display your book, which cover, I think, is very, very artfully designed. And I think sort of conveys the rich themes that we are going to be talking about in our conversation. So let's get right to that. One of the things I was struck by, Marion, right at the start was you drew your inspiration for this novel from an overheard fragment of conversation on a ferry in Hong Kong. Two questions derived from that in my mind. First of all, had you been aware of the fact of the Shanghai ghetto yourself prior to this book?
I had not been aware at all. Mm-hmm. And that overhearing was ignited me. Mm-hmm. I had to write about this in fiction. I sometimes say that Henry James said, a writer is someone on whom nothing is lost. And I said, does that include eavesdropping? And the reason I was so amazed by it is because I'm Jewish. I certainly, the Holocaust is a theme that haunts me as it does the world. And when I heard someone talking, they mentioned a Sephardic name. And the Sephardics being the Jews that were expelled from Spain,
right,
who went to Syria and Iraq and Turkey. And my father was Sephardic, and he came from Syria. And I thought, in back of me, they're talking this name, which was Kaduri, which apparently is a very famous Sephardic name, which I did not know. And they're putting this name, juxtaposing it with Shanghai. And I thought, what does one have to do with the other? How could that be? And he lived there and that he was very influential there. Of course, I went home and did my homework and my research. And I realized the thing that ignited me was what you alluded to at the beginning, is this was the only place you could go without a visa.
Right, right.
Even the United States, you had to have your police record that you were of good character for the past 5 years. Mm. Well, these Germans, many of them were fleeing concentration camps, and they were leaving illegally.
Exactly.
So certainly they didn't have
exactly.
that. They didn't have that.
Marion, that's a very, very profound answer, and one that leads me to this next question based on it. Being that moved by hearing the name Kaduri and this new association in Shanghai, what then led you to say to yourself, but you are, of course, a writer, but to say to yourself, it will be a novel, it will be a work of creative fiction that will reveal the truth about this experience? Why did you decide on the novel?
Well, this idea on its own was so fascinating, but it absolutely fed right in and blended with another theme that haunts me. And that is how the previous generation affects, and as I always say, afflicts the next generation. And while we get strength and we get so many wonderful things, we have to bear the burden, because they had to bear the burden of what their parents kind of, if you will, laid on them.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Marion, that is such a rich answer. I have to confess the truth. For me, our conversation is already off to a very rich start, because that's my very next question, this whole business of generations. And let me, for our viewers now, kind of set the context here and not betray the story, but at least reduce it to a sentence or two to this effect. It's the death of Hannah King, I think.
Yes.
Hannah King, that leads to the revelation of her past, Hannah's past, to her daughter. And Hannah's past was as a refugee in Shanghai,
right.
the kernel of our story. This revelation shocks her daughter, Maya, with whom she had had a very tense relationship. And this shock to Maya comes at a time when Maya is having a tense and alienated experience with her husband, Harold, at the same time. Speak to us a little bit about this relationship and about this generational factor. I mean, to be precise, the fact that someone like Hannah, who had had such a traumatic experience in her youth, kept it as a secret, but then had this tense relationship with her own daughter, it made me think that the relationship between the survivors and their children is a much more complex thing than I might have imagined.
Well, that is exactly what I was addressing. We know this when we speak about people who have been, whose parents have been in the actual concentration camps, mm-hmm. which is we call the Holocaust. But this is a little known chapter of the Holocaust. And of course, they were Germans who fled the Nazis, and they had relatives who perished. So this is the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Hannah is so changed by this experience. And just like many children of Holocaust survivors will tell you, my parents never spoke about it. They never talked about it. My parents never talked about it at all. Mm-hmm. I thought I was so smart in my class. I was the top of my class. I went to a very good college. I never knew almost anything about the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Why? Because my parents wanted to protect me. And Hannah wants to protect Maya and her children. She wants to make in America a wonderful, nice world, as we all do for our children.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, it would be valuable to know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Maya would have made different choices in her life,
right.
if she had known what she knew.
Yeah.
And she would not have judged her mother, for one thing, so harshly.
Yeah, there is a big factor of difficulty in communication here.
Absolutely.
We're speaking. And one of the aspects of that, Marianne, which was intriguing to me, is that Maya, throughout her life, knows it's very difficult to get along with her mother, to communicate and such. Part of that is reflected in what I think would be Maya's envy of her brother, Barry, who she doesn't even know is Barry for Baruch, which means blessed. She doesn't know that until she traumatically discovers it,
yes.
on later in life. But Hannah, the mother, seems to have developed a different feeling about the two children. Is that right?
I think people have said to me, why did you put Barry in this book?
Mm-hmm.
And I think I really did it because there was, we must face it, a favoritism toward the boy. The boy was the golden one.
He wasn't.
And the daughter was just there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, especially, you're going to have a son who's going to be a doctor, and he's in America, and this is the dream of so many immigrants,
mm-hmm.
and so many people. And they could not have it. Hannah could not have an education. She came from a very well-educated family.
Right.
Her father's a math professor in Berlin, and there was no college for her there. She was almost a commoner,
yeah.
compared to what they had been in Berlin. And of course, she wanted the next generation, her children, to have everything, and to have a son who would go to Harvard and be a doctor. There was nothing bigger than that.
Exactly. You know, I'm very glad you mentioned the affluence of Hannah's background, and the prestige, rather, of her father as a math,
yes.
professor. Because here's something, Marianne, I wanted to talk to you the minute I read the book. And let me see if I can phrase it this way. It's implicit. It's explicit in certain points, but implicit throughout the book, and particularly in the character of Hannah's father. And that is the difficulty many upper middle class or middle class German Jews had in perhaps understanding what was just about to hit them, what was coming their way, the fact that the Holocaust was going to rob them of a Germany that in many cases they really loved. It reminded me of a movie you may have seen some years ago called The Garden of the Finzi Contini.
Yes,
it took place in Italy. It was the same sort of phenomena, I thought.
Well, this is so interesting because the whole reason, there were 20,000, mostly Germans, who came. And this was the last place they could see themselves and would have wanted to go. But many of them waited and waited and waited, and they thought that Hitler would pass over. It would just pass. And they were Germans first. They were very much part of their community. They were very proud of their Germanic background. And they didn't realize that the world, or the world of that time, was reducing them to just Jews, which was a lower form of being at that time. And so that's it just took them so very long, because one of the things I often think about is, if my family were in that situation, would my father have left? Isn't it interesting that some people left? In fact, one of the women I interviewed, I said to her, how did your father realize to go? Because some people didn't go. And in my book, I have one of the brothers who just isn't leaving his dining room chair. He is not going to leave his home. This is his home. And he perished, of course. And she said, well, he was a doctor, and they took away his license. And he realized that this was more serious than most people thought. And he actually sent her and her sister on to Denmark 2 years before they actually all ended up in Shanghai.
Right.
So the very fact that they were German, it almost harmed them. They were so nationalistic and assimilated.
Yeah.
They were quite assimilated, and they were proud of their stature. And no one could imagine, just as we could never imagine 9/11 until it happened. You do not imagine in this life that anything like this is going to happen.
I think that's an excellent comparison. It was exactly that catastrophic for them. Let's talk a bit about the attitudes that would confront people, the people we're talking about, as they came to Shanghai with this kind of feeling that you just explained here. Hannah's father, for example, is constantly saying it's more beautiful in Germany.
Yeah.
So even as he is confronted with the reality of Shanghai, that's lingering.
Bei uns in Deutschland.
Bei uns in Deutschland.
Bei uns in Deutschland.
Over and over again, that was
his
refrain. In Shanghai itself, what kind of attitudes met them? Let's talk about, first of all, the Chinese population with which they immediately dwelt, and we'll talk about Hongqiu, the district they dwelt in. But what were their relations with the Chinese, do you think?
Well, the Chinese, first of all, the Chinese were very happy to have a lot of doctors come in. Many doctors came in, because the famous Vienna Medical School, where Freud had gone, all those doctors and medical students were thrown out of the school, and all their licenses were revoked. So this was a terrific place for doctors to go. So they appreciated that. And they felt, the Jews felt very sorry for the Chinese, because they had just been in this war around 1937, been hammered by Japan. And in fact, the physical environment was all broken down and so forth.
Squalid.
Very squalid, and just in time for the Jews to come. And they, of course, when they had to live in this total squalor, they fixed it up as best they could. At first, it was all right, but then the problem is that the Jews were so desperate at some point that they would take any job. That meant that they could take a Chinese person's job, even be a rickshaw puller, what have you.
Right.
And so there was a bit of, I would say, when the chips were down, only once they were put into the ghetto, if it was me or you, the person, because at that time, everyone's scrambling for a place to live.
Exactly. It's a rivalry.
Yes.
The attitude of the Japanese is very interesting, because now the Japanese obviously are the allies of Nazi Germany.
Right.
And they, of course, they are running Shanghai after they've invaded it. There's a very interesting kind of prelude to this story from the Japanese side. In the early 30s, they had devised an extraordinarily bizarre thing called the Fugu Plan. which in turn is based on one of the most extraordinary anti-Semitic documents of all time, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Yes.
And in this document, they developed this plan where they were going to attract Jewish refugees to Shanghai to exploit them, basically. The plan fell apart, but, well, maybe I should ask you, how do you characterize Japanese attitudes toward these Jewish settlers?
It's so remarkable. From the Jews' point of view, it was divine providence that stepped in to help them. Mm-hmm. But it was based on profound anti-Semitism.
Exactly.
But they believed this forgery that was an anti-Semitic list of articles, mm-hmm. saying that the Jews' goal was to take over the world. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese learned a lot of this from the white Russians who had fled the revolution. And they had fought with them in Siberia. And they really believed that Jacob Schiff, who lent money to a Jewish financier who lent money to Japan, that he controlled the Congress, and that people like Bernard Baruch could tell Roosevelt what to do. Mm-hmm. So they felt that they wanted to be in their good graces. They felt they could have all the riches come to them. And they first had the idea of having this colony in Manchuria,
right.
because they had
mm-hmm.
resources there, and they wanted the monies to come there and the people to come there. It's magically wonderful for the 20,000 people that were saved, mm-hmm. but it's insidious
that it would be based on such a
that it's based
lie.
On mm-hmm. such mm-hmm. anti-Semitism
right.
that it's you can't even imagine.
Exactly. History is nothing but irony after irony.
Yes,
I suppose.
Irony is the word. Irony is definitely the word.
Reading your book made me read another book as well, which I know you read among the many that you used for your research, Shanghai Refuge by Ernest Heppner. And it gives a very, very vivid picture of this Hongqiu district in which ultimately the ghetto got really confined. It was, and I use the word squalor, it was absolutely terrible, wasn't it? I mean, people were dying. Just the sanitary conditions under which Jewish refugees lived were awful.
Well, it was so unsanitary mm-hmm. that they would put rice out on the window and let it wait for 45 minutes so that the bugs could come out of it mm-hmm. before they would eat it. Mm-hmm. They had no heat. And they had no toilets. They had buckets that they had to take to the street to put excrement in a cart. So you have five people living in a room. I'm exaggerating, but the size of this table, no privacy, no place to actually wash your clothes. There was a meningitis outbreak, and they were saying that perhaps even you could. People thought you could get it from riding in a rickshaw, and maybe you could, because everyone was so unsanitary. One of the things that the food vendors, when I read this, the food vendors would inject their watermelons with water from the Wangpu River, which
oh
was
my God.
So polluted, because they wanted them to look healthier and they wanted them to weigh more.
I can even imagine how awful that is.
And the only thing they had was sulfa.
Right.
And that could only do but so much.
Yeah.
If you got typhoid, you had to hope that your fever would break. And one of the women whom I interviewed was lucky enough that she survived. Her sister did not.
Right.
And because there was nothing to treat it with.
Yeah. Marian, at one level, this is a story of Hannah and the life that she had led, Maya, the life she's struggling to live, Harold, Sam Asher, Phoebe, many other characters who come into this. It's a frustrated love story in a very affluent Westchester County in New York City. And, of course, it's a story based on horrors in Shanghai generation earlier. But, and here's the question, Marian Cuba, is it also a larger story? What's universal here? I mean, in our day and age, when we think of Darfur, we think of immigration,
exactly.
we think of people moving about this world in miserable conditions. What does the reader take, should the reader take from this? In that sense.
I thought of that, of Darfur. I even went back all the way. I say to you once, we are all survivors.
Mm-hmm.
We are survivors in that we have a collective knowledge, whether we're actual survivors of a certain horrible event. But we are survivors of 9/11. Mm-hmm. I live in New York City. You're in Washington. We survived, so literally we are survivors. But what comes with that is a certain amount of, a special amount of thought that the way you will live your life, the mm-hmm. choices that you will make. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, people who, I'm sure my parents were not literally in the Holocaust. One was born here and one was born in Syria, mm-hmm. so my father was not in that. But they absorbed the attitudes and worried and learned and knew, and they were afflicted and affected by what happened. And they passed that on to their children. And we dealt with it in the way that we could. In my case, I've been haunted by these themes my whole life, and it culminates in this book. My children, I also wanted to protect them from certain things, but they do know that about the subject. And it's interesting you should bring up the Finzi Contini's, because when my children were going to religious school, they wanted to show the movie in the synagogue, mm-hmm. and they had to get my permission because they wanted to be sure that we wanted our children. We were making the choice for our children to have this knowledge. Mm-hmm. And the knowledge is what makes us survivors and what makes us, it's a universal theme because we all have the losses of the world on our shoulders, back to the Garden of Eden from the time the apple was eaten and knowledge came. From that time on, all the horrors, unfortunately, of our world are upon all of us.
Let's emphasize this, Marian, what you're saying here, that we are all Holocaust survivors if we are wise.
Yes.
And thoughtful and realize that this is part of our experience and we have to learn from it.
Exactly.
And employ it.
And that's another reason why I wish to write the book in a fictional story. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted it to be one person reading the book and one person, the person that they're reading about is one person who lived this. It was a saga, but it was for each person. It was a very personal and close event, and I wanted it to be understood that way.
As a person understands it that way, and as each person reads it and gains that understanding, does it connect us to another of the great Talmudic concepts, and that is of our duty to repair the world, to actually do something about?
Absolutely.
I mean, not just think about it, but do something.
Absolutely. The phrase is tikkun olam, to repair the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's why the knowledge of what we know, it's important to have the knowledge. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's important not to hide it from people, because then you have the obligation to do something about it. We must always act. And that brings up the idea that one of my characters talks about, who was in the Holocaust, and Maya says to him, but your parents were in the Holocaust. How can you continue to believe in God? And he said, well, I have a choice to believe or not to believe. And I choose to believe. And I believe we have to live with intention. We have to live with kavanah every day. And I think that because I say we are all survivors, what does that mean? That means that we must repair this world, each one of us.
That's beautifully expressed. And speaking of that being beautifully expressed, Marian Cuba, this is more than a novel. I mean, this is the kind of book where you can see, I can even visualize people sitting together and talking of it. Have you had that experience with people? Have you seen this used in discussion groups?
Yes. Well, I've actually led a few discussion groups.
What happens in such groups?
Well, the people who didn't know about it, of course, they're very excited that they're learning about it and can't believe that they have learned about it. Mm-hmm. But they'll all bring out, well, yes, my mother did this, just as Hannah in the book. She's so severe about certain things. She's so frightened. She doesn't want her child to reach for the stars because she says there's this one thing that that obviously comes right out of my own background that used to drive my sisters and I crazy and still does if I hear anyone say it. And they say, if you want to do something, travel somewhere or do something. And they say, what do you need it for? And I feel so defeated when someone would say that. And I don't want to feel that. It's not that I need it, it's that I seek it. Mm-hmm. But those people who have suffered, who the closer they are to the Holocaust, they feel that we're so happy just to be alive that we shouldn't ask for anything more. And that's part of the book, too, is that Maya, before she knew Hannah's story, had not asked so much from life because she had not thought that she was almost allowed. And once she saw that her mother really had those dreams too, but her mother unfortunately could not realize them, but her mother made it to this country and was able to have a child, and that child lives in this world, and Maya realizes that she has to look at her life and see if she has been living with intention. She's been taking for granted, and now it looks all very different.
There's a beautiful motif in this book revolving around the brownstone house in townhouse in New York City in which Hannah had died. Maya takes it over, and first she's sort of redecorating in a very radical way, and then I thought she was incorporating more of her mother because she had come to understand the beauty of the example she had been given.
Exactly. In fact, there's an armoire that in which the papers and the diaries are found, in which they are found. And at first she's going to send it off with the antiques dealer. And then he says to her, because his parents were actually survivors, that maybe you should think about it. And so she does, in fact, and is happy that she keeps that part of something that was her mother.
And that's the lesson to us. Keep that part of the history which is ours and live with intention.
Yes.
Marion Cuba, thank you so much for the book, for the conversation. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Marion Cuba. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber, and our assistant producer is Sharana Harris. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.